the source got cut off the bottom of all the sites. So I've been talking a lot to HECSU, the Higher Education and Career Services Unit. They've got some really interesting reports. They have a report called Future Track that they did in 2012, which is where you get the mobility grant from and what they're looking for in jobs. The data about language comes from Textio, and I've also got data from personal communications from people in the industry that isn't yet publicly sourced, but I'm asking them to help me do that. There is a lot of data out there that is just sitting quietly and being ignored, and particularly from HECSU, actually. They've done a huge amount of work in this area, but because their focus, their clients are essentially careers units in universities, the general public, as it were, doesn't pay much attention, but they're a really rich source of information.
One of the things that I generally don't have to worry about
is the aims, objectives and outcomes, because I don't do schools work. No, I really, really don't do schools work. I try not to swear, but I do have a tendency to talk about things that are considered distinctly adult. Because, well, electrocution for fun and profit. What does that bring to mind for a lot of you? I am in a room full of people who play with electricity in some form or another for a living, and none of you have an idea about what I might be talking about.
Edison killing the oven.
Possibly.
Build the dishes.
Yes, maybe. Sword. Because the thing is, when you're trying to create electrostatic charges, you can do what they show you on the internet and get a great white tube of PVC piping. Or you can go to Poundland and buy a kid's plastic sword, which is made of exactly the same stuff and looks a whole lot nicer in front of a bunch of people. Although the number of times I've had to rescue this from a 7-year-old in the last 3 days is... I stopped counting when it got to about 50. Would you take that off the backing board for me? Thank you. So what you're basically getting with me today is quick overview of the sort of process I would go through when I would describe this, including losing control of my tongue, even though I spent a fortune on my teeth. Okay, one of you said that before. Preparing for some form of psychom for performance. You tend to think about the sorts of things that you think might attract a crowd. And I'm getting way up there because apparently this is too far. This is the point you see where I was kind of hoping I'd have two hands to play with, but I'm also a proponent of using microphones because you don't know who's in the room who actually needs you to. One, it might not be being recorded. Two, not everybody hears really well. So if you don't use the mic or you don't repeat questions asked from the floor that were said without the mic, you leave out a large chunk of your potential audience. Which is a thing we need to think about when you're designing talks and you're designing for science communication. You're just designing for performance, full stop. And standing and doing slides in front of other people is just as much performance as climbing on stage with an orchestra or a band, large quantities of music and some steel bowing. Right. Basically, what you're going to get is a variety of things that work as Leyden jars, assuming that I've actually managed to bring everything with me. This is quite a nice little device. Kids toy. And a RAF generator. Doesn't look anything like as cool as the proper generators, but needs a lot less paperwork. I kind of inquired you earlier what sort of paperwork they want for me to bring a band graph generator onto the premises, and I got sent a 3-page form, none of which was actually appropriate because it kept talking about in the lab. Please ensure that there is no water in the vicinity of the kit in the lab. I'm going to have to
only works for one. £2 in Morrison's, I've got 50 plastic cups and these two. But it's a labour job. It's a way of gathering a charge in a capacitor that you just make. You can do it by buying a plastic sword, but it doesn't work so well with this sort of density of metal. One of the other things that I found about this. So when you remember, you actually have all the keys there as well. Many situations that I would probably aim to do this in, I'd probably expect to have an audience who are drinking. If they weren't already drunk, no, you know, remarkably sober for enough people who spent an entire day at the student union crisis. Although I'm noticing that this is very definitely London student union crisis. I was taken to one of the union bars in Manchester a couple of weeks back and, bloody hell, it's cheap up north. Right, we're going to have an experiment. This is something a bit. One of the ones I discovered with the glass that comes with the mixing thing, you just drop it in, it sinks to the bottom, which is kind of no good from a lame job point of view. This is the bit that I only decided to do this morning as I left the house, and therefore I haven't actually practiced. So let's see. The vague idea behind this is to prove the principle. And then I was sat between two PhD candidates, physics PhD candidates, in a BBC microgrid workshop. And after they'd discussed how their personal microgrids weren't working, not the ones in the workshop, the ones that they had at home, they went on to then talk about, over my head, I mean, tall people, I'm really sure, but talk right over my head about what they were planning to do with the TENS machine that they laid their hands on. It was kind of interesting. It's probably where the profit comes in. And eventually, I asked them what happened to the microbit. And one of them said, oh, I'm not really sure. We only put five across it. And the station ensured that they'd actually put 5 amps across it, and had basically proved Pratchett's first law of thermodynamics and let us make out. So it went from being a theoretical thing to being a practical, actual idea, because if you're going to do that sort of stuff, you really don't want to apply too much current. One, it's a bit ouchy. Two, these are soft and delicate tissues. I mean, of course, you know, if June 9th is all too depressing, you can apply everything I say in reverse, but don't sue, because my house is worth less than the mortgage, and death by electrocution is really, really messy. And if you want to know more about that sort of things, there's a really good exhibition at Wellcome Trust at the moment, which I think is open for another few weeks. But I really, seriously, go and sit there. There's loads of stuff in it about electricity parties, and there's some really nice tea towels made by the London Electricity Board in the 50s and 60s, which is kind of weird when you realise that's exactly where your parents worked in that decade, and they still have those at home. Anyway, let's try this. I'm going to have a go at seeing if I can pass an electrostatic charge through a Negroni. I should probably stick to my principles and actually use some. Making a good Negroni is 1/3 Amaro, some form of bitters. Most people use Campari because it's available and relatively cheap and a known flavour. But you pop it in equal measures with gin. Is Campari. This is basically decanted because I wasn't going to bring a whole litre with me. A particularly good, sorry, I could just say this is great, Tanqueray Export, which runs at 44.5%. Somewhere around about a triple in there. I'm not planning on drinking all this, by the way. I'm not going to have that. And then the final third. It's doable, it's not an old-fashioned 5 minute stir. Is a sweet vermouth. Sweet vermouth is quite an interesting thing. Because it was, despite being famously dry, quite a lot of the US clinics that used electrocution as a medical treatment also used sweet vermouth, dabbed onto people's bodies before they gave them the electric shock therapy, because they discovered that the combination of alcohol and grapes, when applied to the sweat of someone who has been recently electrocuted, smelled sweet. If you electrocuted or gave electric shock therapy to somebody who had not had an alcoholic sweetening substance put on their skin, what you got was quite a sour, acrid, almost garlic-like smell, which was apparently the lipids in the glands in their necks burning off. You really didn't need to know that, but I think you can kind of imagine the smell then. Anyway, let's do this. Let's have a little stir. Sorry, I've got you to take that off the board, and then I haven't used it because I ran out of time, and I realised that there are only so many jokes that you can make about rubbing swords with electrostatically chargeable cloths. Yeah, I see, I did warn you. That's like a game, it should work in the same principle as the glass in the jar, but let's see. I tend to stick to the geek or the book show-offs, but we're really good fun that we have them in a bar, in a bookshop. Which enables me to talk about how books will be the death of me, but that's another thing. But the other thing that I do that you really ought to know about is an annual convention known as London Geek Fest, Online Worlds. And we have a really strong tech track. We aim to be a conference where you can come for the weekend for the cost of a fraction of a day's tech conference and actually get a really good run of sessions of things that are about being geeky and also being yourself and being technologically. And we do have some leaflets lying around out there, and yeah, I'm plugging like mad because basically please all come and make it worthwhile. And I'm doing this. Thank you. Goodbye.
Absolutely stunning natural landscapes. really want to go there on holiday. But I'm actually curious about what makes a city beautiful and what environments in a city are actually beautiful and worth preserving. So the question is, though, well, you know, if we think of how we think about beauty, then we can imagine that's probably quite subjective. So our preferences might be shaped by, you know, our social influences or cultural influences. But I want to know if there's a collective understanding of beauty we can measure. And I went to theories of evolution. So we can imagine that we might have evolved to prefer certain settings, and that might inform us if there is actually a collective idea of beauty that we might be able to measure. So there's one theory, is the biophilia hypothesis from Cullen and Wilson. They say that we have this innate connection to nature because we've evolved to find these things that are attractive that might have our survival, for example, like fruit-bearing or climbable trees. So that, you know, explains our affinity to all these, like, beautiful natural landscapes. There's another study, though, I find really interesting. This is Jay Abelson's Prospect and Refuge Theory. And it says that we evolved to prefer spaces that one can easily view prospects, as well as ones that might contain refuge, where one can easily hide and avoid potential danger. So this one's a little bit broader. It gives us a little bit more scope to perhaps define what beauty is. So in the past, how have they actually tried to measure what's beautiful? They've used, you know, so this is a study from Werick from 2000, and they used to do this visual survey methods, and they asked people to rate these images. And so there's about like 90 images that have been rated, and then they kind of use this very basic computational techniques to extract visual features. But, you know, this is a handful of images and a handful of characteristics. Well, this doesn't really tell us anything that interesting or that insightful until now. So luckily today, we're spending a lot of time on the internet, maybe too much time sometimes, but the great thing about it is, for data scientists like me, is that it's a fantastic source of data. And one of these great sources of data is actually online games. So I was very excited when I came across this website, originally built by My Society. And it's a little game you play, you just rate these images between 1 and 10. And what's happening in the background is each image actually represents a square kilometer of the United Kingdom. So if we look at a map of the most scenic areas around England, you'll see the places that people tend to go hiking tend to come up as being most scenic, like, you know, the Lake District, Devon, Somerset. So, you know, from that random image, we actually have a really interesting pattern of what most scenic areas are. So by the time I came across this data, I've got about 217,000 images that have been rated 1.5 million times. So how the hell do I go about analyzing all this data? And this is where deep learning and neural networks come to the rescue. And I think there's a few people that might not know what deep learning is, so I'll give you a really quick overview. So basically, deep learning is the reason why we've had so much success in things like computer vision. So for example, like facial recognition, but also speech recognition. And you must have heard about the news headlines where a computer algorithm actually beat the world's champion player in Go. And the idea behind neural networks, if you think about, so first of all, think about how do you tell the difference between a 0 and a 6? If we're trying to develop a computer program to differentiate between numbers, and we're trying to write a bunch of rules to differentiate, it gets quite complicated. So some 0s and 6 might be obviously very different, but you see the ones in the middle, well, that's kind of ambiguous. So you can imagine this, the rules that you have to have program can get very cumbersome, really long. And then you've only got 0s and 6s, and you haven't even gotten to the 1s and 7s. So, you know, you make these, like, very complicated program. It takes, like, several hours to actually do anything useful. You know, it's completely useless. A better way to write a computer program is whether the computer can actually learn to infer rules by itself. And this set of techniques is often referred to as machine learning. And one of these machine learning algorithms that's actually really interesting is neural networks. And neural networks, in a nutshell, have basically been inspired by how we imagine the neurons in the brain work. And what's really interesting about these neural networks is they can actually learn to see, like especially with computer vision tasks, they actually learn to see patterns. So for example, if we're looking handwritten digits, they're learning to see the lines and loops that make up the numbers. And we can build more and more layers. so that each subsequent layer is actually learned to recognize a more complex pattern based on a more simple pattern. And you can imagine that we can make these models deeper, and the more deeper they are, the more layers they are, they actually learn really quite well. And that's where the deep learning comes from. But it isn't that simple, so you can't just add layers like endlessly and think this model is going to get better. A big problem we have with deep learning models is they can overfit. What that means is that when we train a deep learning model, we show it, for example, you basically find it, maybe like a child, you show them pictures of cats and dogs, and say, this is a cat, this is a dog, and you can train a deep model to be perfect, so every time it looks at the images it sees, it knows exactly that's a cat, and that's exactly like a dog. But the problem is that model is too perfect. If it sees a new image that it has never seen before, it will have no idea what it's seen. So researchers actually spend an incredible amount of time trying to find a way to create neural networks that actually work really well. So for example, this is Google's Inception network. It's quite complex. And also it's an example of how it won an image classification contest in 2014, and it's incredibly good at picking up and looking at an image and actually picking up objects out of it. So I'm actually used one of these neural networks. It's from MIT, it's called Places. And this neural network is very good at recognizing places, the scenes. So for example, if you look at the kind of things you can extract, there's an image of skyscrapers, there's an image of a coast, and it tells you that, well, I think, you know, the probability of 60% is a skyscraper in there, maybe 27% is a tower in there. But also, I can get other features out of it. There's called scene attributes as well. That's from a layer a bit before it goes to predict the place. And I can see, you know, is it an open area? Are there like clouds in the picture? You know, can you see away to the far away horizon? So it gives me a lot of really interesting information. So what I did was that I ran like 217,000 images through this neural network, and I can extract quite a bunch of variables. So there's 365 place categories, and there's 102 scene attributes. So for each image now, I have a very good understanding of exactly what each image is actually composed of. So the next thing is, so if we look at some of these images, in general, what the model has picked up on, so the first row is these scenic images, and they tend to accord with what we think about as beautiful landscapes. You know, you've got your beautiful lakes, you've got your beautiful forest scenes, but also like charming ruins, and also views where you can see to the distant horizon. And the most scenic images, unsurprisingly, tend to be these road networks, you know, industrial areas, not so nice buildings. But I thought what was interesting as well is that, you know, large flat areas of green space are getting rated, are also considered to be unscenic. And also, you might have a beautiful view, but if you have an industrial object in the distance, that's also getting rated as being unscenic. And I also want to see what does scenic mean in urban built-up areas. And again, you see images that might be reminiscent of the countryside. So we have, you know, these lakes, images of trees as well, you know, gardens. But you also have these like little, you know, cottages coming, so there's like historical buildings, as well as bridge-like structures that are also coming up. But let's quantify this. So what I did was I built an ElasticNet model, and the only thing you need to know about that model is that it helps you do variable selection. So remember, I've got hundreds of variables, and you need to identify the variables that will help me predict scenicness. And if I look at that, so what it gives me, so this is looking at all images, as well as in an urban built-up setting, so I get your natural kind of valley coast mountain, and in urban areas you get like canals and ponds and trees, and you get your man-made objects, construction site, parking lot, and industrial areas. But the message isn't that simple. You also find that it picks up on these historical buildings and cottages and castles, as well as these bridge-like structures like aqueduct and viaduct. And interestingly, grass does not come up well, but I think it's that scenes with a lot of grass or like athletic fields are just flat, they're uninteresting. They don't have trees, they don't have valley contours, and that's why this model is actually picking up on that. And another interesting thing I found out is that it picked up on something. So remember the prospect refuge theory. So if you have if you have these large flat open areas, which is different from open spaces, so a large flat open area might make you feel vulnerable. and an area where you have no horizon, you actually can't view. So it might be that these pictures are considered, that we might be picking these pictures out as being unseen because of evolution preferences. It could also be that they're just not interesting pictures. So I don't know, I kind of just speculate. But it's interesting that, you know, our definition of uniqueness is very complicated. It's not so straightforward. So the next question I want to know is actually, can I predict uniqueness for images where I don't have crowdsourced ratings for? So I want to go back to these neural networks. And can I build a deep learning model to actually predict the beauty of images that it hasn't seen before? So, what I have to do is a bit complicated. So, if you actually want to build a neural network from scratch, you need millions and millions of images to train it. And I don't have millions of images. So, a technique you can do is actually called transfer learning. And what you can do is you can take the information from one neural network and transfer the information to another neural network. So remember that I have my original neural network, which is a places, that's very good at predicting the place category. So it, you know, knows whether an image is a courtyard or an ocean. So what I can do is I can basically chop off the last layer, feed it, and change that last layer to, and ask it to predict the sceneness instead. And you basically, you only need a few thousand images to train it, and it actually becomes quite good. And I can get, so far, the accuracy is 0.66 on test data, which is data images it's never seen before, which is the correlation between the predicted and the actual scenic ratings. But let's see what it's done. So so I took all these images from another website called Geographic all around London, and I wanted to see what it predicted. And well, one of my favorite areas, most beautiful areas I think in London, is Hampstead. I'll spend some time there, and I want to see what it predicted. So if you look at the dots, I hope you can see the colors, they're not so great, but the green and the purple dots are where you find the scenic spots are, and they're all like centered around them. You can see like in the heat, it's really picked that up. And here's one of the images that it shows. And if you look at central London, it's also all the like green dots that are scenic are around like places being all my thing are pretty, like Regent's Canal, Regent's Park, you know, all around the Thames. But interestingly, it doesn't just favor nature as being beautiful. So it also does, it's smart enough to know that if you have this large, flat, boring green area, that it's not scenic. So it's pretty smart. And another thing I found that was really interesting is that it doesn't just pick up these natural areas. There's a nice cluster of scenic images around Tower Hill, and it's basically picked up as well about beautiful buildings being scenic as well. So I'll just give you some, here's some examples of some of the top 5% predicted scenic images in London. You know, these beautiful natural ones, but there are also these, you know, beautiful fountains, statues, you know, buildings. So I don't know, I was pretty proud of the neural network. It's need to learn well. So, just to quickly summarize, beautiful places are beneficial to our well-being. The definition of beautiful places is more complex than the simple, what is natural is beautiful. And natural features might not be beautiful if they're just largely flat or uninteresting, but also that built-up features can also be beautiful. So, thank you.
This matches with a belief that I have that if we If we aim for, if we focus on all of the stuff that is shit, then that's where we aim towards. Whereas if we focus on all of the stuff that is good or our dreams, then we can aim towards what is good, and we can make that happen. This is like a kind of attractors that we have, right? The attractor that you focus on is the route that you choose to take. And the, so why don't we try to focus on the good? So that made me think about what is that good? What is that vision? What is our dream? And of course, because I'm Jamie Tennyson and I work for the Open Data Institute, then I care about the open data dream. And what is that? What does that look like? What does that future, if it was really perfect, what does that look like? So I'm going to talk about that. The first component was touched on a bit earlier in Gavin's talk as well. In our perfect open data future, then society recognises that data is infrastructure for our day-to-day lives. That getting data to people who need it, whether they're citizens or businesses or governments, is so important that we have to invest in it. Certain data sets that are absolutely crucial for the running of the country are subsidised, they are protected as critical national infrastructure. Addresses are free. That's an in-joke. Data as infrastructure means that we invest in making data high quality. Instead of having the rough roads that we have to struggle down, we have motorways of data. Data that is infrastructure is linked together. We don't have disconnections between the roads that we think of as our data infrastructure. Instead, they are linked into interconnections which enable us to make journeys really easily. Data as infrastructure is data that everybody can access, and I'll come on to that in a bit, but you notice on this road how there are cars that are taking individuals, there are lorries that are shipping stuff for companies, it is enabled for ambulances to use, everybody can use these roads. In just the same way, where data is infrastructure, everybody can use it for all sorts of purposes. So in that future, data is infrastructure, it's invested in, we recognise it, and we also collaborate over it. It isn't something that is just built by government, it is something that we all can contribute to, and we don't... I'll come on to some examples of this, but that citizens and businesses, charities and government can collaborate over created, strong and reliable and useful data. So that's the first bit. Second bit, data is taught. So here I mean that data is something that is an essential skill. It's taught as data literacy. We expect everybody to have it. So we teach it right from the very start. And not just about data science and kind of what you can do with data once you have it, but also that very basic understanding of the power of data and what it can do and what it means in society. And then, if you like, a kind of data literature instead of a data language. Data is taught as part of courses in university to help business people to know how they can use data to make businesses run better, to help policymakers in politics courses know how they can use data as a tool to enact their policies. It is not the province purely of data scientists. Data is something that everybody can talk about and do something with. Third thing, data is used. It is used across society. It's used by citizens, it's used by businesses, it's used in small companies, it's used in big companies, it's used in government, it's used in NGOs. People use it to make decisions. They use it to inform their decisions. Most decisions are better decisions because they have used data to reach them. But to get to that stage, we also have to have data being trusted. We, in this future, trust the data that we receive, that it is true, that it's being collected well. And we also trust in the way organisations are using that data. We have built up a trusting relationship with the organisations that hold and do things with data, that make decisions with data. How's that trust achieved? Well, data is used ethically. We have some understanding, some moral code around how data should be used and how it should not be used. We have discussions about what that means. We let our ideas be criticised and talked about and discussed so that we get to a better result in using data ethically. Data is used in order to create trust. Data is used not just in the province of the big and the powerful, but also by everyone. It's something that anybody can get hold of and anybody can use. So in the same way as the street is used by cyclists and people walking and buses and taxis and vans, data is used by everyone. And data is used in consultation. We talk about it, we discuss it. It is the case that technology will move on, that we will have different data sources, that we will have different capabilities about how we use data, and therefore we have an ongoing discussion about what is right and what is good and how data should be used. So, in that dream, strong data infrastructure, data skills at every level of society, we have innovation with data, people using it to do new and exciting things. We have trust in the way that data is being used, because it is used ethically, because there is some equity in its use, and because there's engagement around where it is used. So that's the dream, that's my dream, that's what I'm aiming towards. Classic again quote. The future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed. There are things going on right now in the way that data is being used that point us towards this future. And I thought I'd list a few of them. So this is the bill for the digital public bill from France. You can see there Macron was the economics minister behind it, along with my absolute hero, Axel Mayr. This bill included provisions to say that particular data sets were so important that they were going to invest in them. Particular data sets, like addresses, really needed to be, were so crucial for the economy that they would be made open. So we can see there, governments prepared to recognise data as infrastructure. This example from earlier this week, CityMapper, using Open Transport for London data, obviously built the app that many of us use in order to help navigate around the city, but then are starting to investigate how they turn that into a tool for providing more intelligent mobility using buses, using public transport infrastructure. And there, that partnership between the public sector providing data and providing a platform for the private sector to then innovate over and provide a public service back. I just think it's interesting. I don't know where it will go, but I think it's an interesting pointer to what could be. When I was thinking of good things, I was thinking, how many of you know about Godan? It's the Global Open Data in Agriculture and Nutrition Initiative. Okay. And those of us in the some of us in the open data space don't know about this, which is absolutely amazing. I went to this conference last year, and they had 800 people signed up for this conference around open data in agriculture and nutrition. who are completely outside of our normal communities, right? People from businesses, from NGOs, from who care about open data because they can see the potential it has for agriculture and nutrition, not because they care about open data. And that spread of basic open data thinking across different sectors, I think, is a really good sign. This is a slightly esoteric screenshot just to remind me what to talk about, which is OpenStreetMap as a model, and the way in which private sector organisations, including Facebook, are putting data back into this kind of data infrastructure, these shared collaborative data infrastructure spaces like OpenStreetMap, but also to talk about the number of applications and services that are being built on top of this fundamental platform of OpenStreetMap, and that are providing value back both to communities and to businesses, but also to the creators of these applications. An incredibly rich ecosystem of organisations, applications, tools that are built around this fundamental open data infrastructure. This is an obvious just plant for a piece of work that we're doing at Open Data Institute, Open Active. This is a project which is using data to get people more active by persuading the organisations that provide physical activities, so gyms and clubs, that kind of thing, to publish open data about those activities so that it can be incorporated into tools and services to help people get more active, to help them find out where they can be more active. I think this is interesting because, again, it is creating a data infrastructure not by government going out and collecting the data for itself and then publishing it, but by getting people to collaborate in a very distributed way, and private sector organisations, what's more, to collaborate in this distributed way to build up a data infrastructure that can actually have an impact on people's lives and well-being. And then this is another like plant and advert, because I'm on the Co-op Digital Advisory Board. So to demonstrate this, that we're starting to have these conversations outside conferences like this, but also with normal people about the way in which data should be used. Co-op is having an event on Friday, which is looking at trust and transparency for Co-op and how it should be interacting with its customers and its members in order to handle data better. So that engagement piece you can start to see coming through as well. Okay, so I've talked about the vision, I've talked about how some of those things are coming through right now. Final piece of my talk is to talk about avoidance and traps. And I have five because I don't like four. So my five traps are, first of all, complacency. I think that we took our eye off the ball with open data, in particular in the UK, thought it was done and thought that the arguments were won, and it simply isn't true. We have to make the arguments again and again, especially as new officials, new politicians come into play. We have to beware of open washing. Gavin talked about open banking earlier on. It's a fantastic initiative and fantastic set of recommendations that came out of the CMA, Competition Markets Authority. Unfortunately, translated into action, if you go and have a look at the open license that they are publishing their open data under, it is not at all. It is revocable. There are various things you cannot do with that data, but they cling to the openness as being a differentiating factor when it's not. And the danger of that is that we let our standards slip. If we let our standards slip, we don't get the benefits that we actually know only come from true openness. So that's a danger we have to look out for. Third slide, piece of danger to avoid, trap to fall into, is failure to adapt. We have to change our messaging. Sometimes if we haven't succeeded at one particular message, we have to, if we're banging our heads against a brick wall, sometimes you have to go over it or around the side or underneath it. You have to change the way in which you're talking about the benefits of open data or benefits of open full stop. I don't know exactly what those are at the moment, but the line that we've found effective is talking about the data economy. It's talking about having friction-free data flows and so on. But these are we need different language for a different set of circumstances and different arguments for different sets of circumstances. That said, when I told that to Peter, he said, yeah, but sometimes you just have to keep bashing on the wall. And that is also true. Giving up just because it's not working this first time is also a danger that we should try to avoid, because sometimes those cracks start showing and you just have to keep on banging. I hope that's the case around land registry, for example. And of course, the whole point of this talk was to say, do not fall into despair. That's a trap that can lead us away from hope and lead us away from our dreams. And so, final quote. We did not come to fear the future. We came here to shape it. If you're here and you've been here through the day, if you're here at Open Tech, then you're here because you want to shape the future. Hold on to your dreams, head towards them, and we will make it a better place.